So, Bruce, you've cited a small library here in order to justify this decision, and yes, it's legal to go do it. But, I mean, the average pilot faced with this situation, look, water's in the database, it's only one out. How important is it to really match up everything? Or, look, I'm going to be picked up on radar soon. Just get up and going in the right direction.
Well, it's important to make sure that the procedure hasn't changed between versions. You've got different courses or altitudes or something. But the AIM actually says when you're verifying the data, it's not necessary to go in and verify the latitude and longitude to three decimal points. Basically, it says you make a reasonable effort to confirm that those named fixes match up to what the current procedure is. And then once you load this procedure, you can look at – you've loaded ELWA and water. You can then look at the flight plan list in your box and see what the course is.
So that would be the second part of it. You spelled out very clearly how to decide you could go, but to actually verify that it hadn't changed. So you're saying you'd go to the flight plan and it's really the course to water, and as long as water's the same name, we're good to go.
Yeah. That would get you most of the way there in your confidence. The real point here is you should have these basic facts in mind if you're using these boxes in your airplane.
Is everyone in agreement, just fly the water six, or we're going to do something different here? I am curious, looking around the table.
I agree with the concept of use the water six, but I would want to do a deeper look at where the fixes are, because just because a fix has the same name is not a guarantee that it's going to be in exactly the same spot as the prior version of the procedure.
How would you do that, though? I mean, practically speaking, sitting on the ground, you've got an iPad and you got an airplane with a GPS in it. How would you go about actually making sure they hadn't changed?
Well, there is a list of the intersections, and in buried deep in the FAA website, there's a couple of inch thick handbook that lists every intersection with either its lat long or its radial DME. So that would be one way of doing it, but that's pretty ponderous.
Yeah, practically speaking, walk back into the FBO and
it's not going to happen.
Yeah, not going to happen.
The only thing that I'll add is if you look at the chart for the Water 7 departure or any other similar procedure, it'll give you details on the location. And if you're looking at the specific bearings and radials or even a lat long that defines it, then that is going to put you in a more confident position to know that that fix hasn't moved since the database that you're looking at.
Yeah, go back to your flight plan once you've loaded those fixes in and compare the fix names, the track between those fixes. In this case, you're just joining a leg essentially. And what's the distance between those two? Does that match what's on the chart? Those are all confidence building measures to give you an idea that you're good enough to go on this.
I think this whole thing is going in the wrong direction. From the beginning, I would have not filed as a slash golf, and I would have put no SIDS, no stars in the remarks and just made it simplified all of this. Now, maybe that's going to cause a delay getting out of there, but I'm certainly not going to screw up and violate any rules here.
So if you're going to file no SIDS, no stars, how are you getting out of this airport, Bob? Because if I go to the list of departures that say looking for an ODP out of this airport, and there's some rather large mountains
off one side
of the airport, right? There is no textual ODP for this airport. It does not exist because the graphical one has displaced it.
So therefore, it may cause a delay here. If I can't figure out an ODP accessing a sectional chart, I just wouldn't do it.
So you actually wouldn't depart the airport?
No.
Even with water to one side of you, the Strait of Juan de Fuca is there, nothing to hit, you wouldn't go?
No. If I could ensure that I had a departure lane to get out of there without obstacles, I would go. But as I said, it may cause a delay here waiting for weather so that I could ensure that I could get into radar contact at some altitude where I was still VFR. That's my take on it. I would not have filed slash golf.
One thing I'm interested in, though, is the telephone numbers with a direct line to ATC are relatively new, at least for most airports. And they're primarily there for receiving a clearance or canceling an IFR flight plan after you land at a non-towered airport. It's not exactly clear how far you can go if you get the controller on the phone and negotiate an unpublished departure procedure in this case.
Good point, Bruce.
So you might be able to work it at a facility like Whidbey that isn't super busy. It's probably not going to work really well at a really busy facility. I just don't know, but it's an interesting thing to test out, I think.
Well, you know, in looking at the chart supplement here, there is no number published, and this is something I've noticed. They tend not to publish the numbers if there's an RCO that you can reach. They're expecting you to go through and reach the RCO directly.
You have two options there. You could look at another airport nearby that may have a telephone number published. The number is going to be the same for the facility, except in a few rare cases, I think, where the super busy facilities like SoCal, where they've got so many airports, they might have multiple numbers. So that's your first option. Pick another one and try to reach them using that number.
So, yeah, and in that case, you might be able to negotiate something like, you know, enter controlled airspace heading 360 or something like that. Just one clarification on your point, Bob, though. This is not an RNAV or RNP procedure.
I understand that.
So filing SLANC Alpha or SLANC Alpha wouldn't make any difference.
Well, I understand that as far as they're concerned.
In terms of what you're going to get back as
whether
a
I could use, whether I was going to be able to use the GPS for this departure procedure, that's where the expectation for ATC would be, I'm not. That's why I'm filing no SIDS. Okay? That would be my logic there.
I'm saying
I'm a basic / alpha airplane.
They're still going to give, well, unless you file no SIDS, no STARS, they're still going to give you this departure procedure, assuming you can fly it with the ADF and the VOR.
Yeah, they could. But that's why you have to put that in the remarks, because you don't really want to do that.
You know, it's an obstacle departure procedure. Yeah, it's an instrument departure procedure, but it's not like, you know, you're refusing a SID.
I hear what you're saying. That's why I'd want to be really certain if I was going to depart with 1,200 overcast, that I had a lane that was clear.
And this is kind of a crazy one here because it's a departure procedure based on a NDB bearing, right? So functionally, this is an RNAV departure these days. I mean, let's face it, how many working ADFs do we have in aircraft, and then how many pilots capable of picking up a bearing and flying it to a waypoint, right? Like, just that's going to confound the average pilot today who maybe never even trained. And the fact that this plane has one is you know, sort of almost circumstance. So it is sort of functionally an RNAV departure. And there's an interesting point there about, well, okay, we could fly this departure with old data, but are we a slant golf aircraft with old data? Is that legitimate?
Well, that gets to the question of what are you going to do after you've flown this departure and now you're en route. And so you're absolutely right that legally you couldn't file slant G. ATC would be expecting you'd be able to, you know, clear down the road. You're simply using the GPS in this case to substitute during this departure procedure. It's a gray area there, but he's planning to go VFR after he gets up, and you know, it's VFR at his destination and so forth. But that may require some negotiating with ATC.
But that is an interesting thing about slant golf. I mean, does that mean that I have approach capability? Or does that just mean I have a functioning GPS on board and can use that GPS for my en route navigation? You know, can I legally file slant golf? And then even further, do I have to go into my ForeFlight and change my whole ICAO filing now and knock out all the
stuff that rely upon the golf?
Right, because now this gets much more complicated these days than just am I slant golf, am I slant alpha? So how am I going to handle that in this situation, knowing that, like, I got to go up, you know, with this airplane with an expired database?
Yeah, you can kind of spell out exactly what your capabilities are with the ICAO equipment, but I'd have to ask the controllers here. From what I understand, they mostly, it's assumed that you have basic IFR approach capability if you file golf, right?
As an approach controller, we don't generally look at equipment suffixes when we're working airplanes for the most part. We're generally making the assumption that everybody's GPS capable, and if they aren't, then it's on the pilot to tell them if they're unable to comply with a control instruction or a routing that they've been given because of their equipment limitations. If we wanted to pull up the old equipment suffixes that everybody's used to, even if you file a ICAO flight plan, like you're saying, with all the different boxes checked, that gets resolved into the legacy domestic letter for flight progress trips in at least terminal facilities. There is an option to go and pull up the more detailed ICAO data if a controller wants to, but I would bet it's a minority of controllers that even know how to do that or would be able to even apply what any of that means. So it's really on the pilot to just communicate to ATC in plain language if you're unable to do a particular thing that ATC is asking you to do.
And just to clarify, Kevin, you're saying that the approach controllers in general these days just assume that you have GPS capability. Like they're not even looking to see whether there's a slant golf on there or not. They're going to assume GPS. And if you can't, you've got to speak up and say, yeah, I don't really have that GPS.
In general terms, I agree with that. To break that down a little bit more, there are a number of facilities that don't use flight progress strips. And it's the controller's job or a controller's job to ensure that the data block on the radar scope is populated correctly with the relevant information. And that's how controllers would work with that.
One of the things that I wonder about here, you know, you said, Bruce, that you can't, you couldn't do this with an old approach, right? But you could do it with the departure. But the approach name may not have changed. I may be pulling my approach with the, I'm following the letter. I'm approaching, pulling the approach from the database with the correct name. The database is 2 years old. What about that situation? Can I fly an approach with an expired database? Let's suppose this pilot needed to go pick up some people or some gear at Boeing Field in Seattle. He's going to fly an approach to get in there as well as the departure.
Well, the limitations in the AFM supplement and in the AIM are pretty explicit about that. You cannot fly an approach with an expired database.
A GPS approach.
Right. So you can still do some substitution of like an outer marker or something like that, but you can't fly an approach. That's why they specifically mention approaches and RNAV procedures like SIDS and STARS that are RNAV based. Remember, this departure procedure is not an RNAV procedure.
Following up on that, if I'm still calling it out by name, that's all that was required in the AIM, doesn't it then just fall to the airplane flight manual supplement as to whether I can fly an approach with an expired database or not? And if it says that as long as the data hasn't changed, I can use the approach?
Most of the AFM supplements that I'm familiar with explicitly say you must have a current database to fly approaches. And that gets into the issue of what's different then about approaches and departure procedures. And I guess the simple answer there, to me anyway, is in an approach, you're getting funneled down toward the ground, toward a runway, toward the obstacles. Departure, you're climbing away from all of that stuff. Plus, if you actually look at TERPs, there's different obstacle clearance surfaces and criteria for when they design these procedures. You have a lot more slop in a departure procedure than you do on an approach. So that's why, to my mind, there's that clear distinction.
And again, just to be a little, get a little techie on all of this here, let's suppose the water wasn't in the database, right? You look at it, but water is, LWA is. You're saying that you could roll your own on this and that would be fine. And your way of doing it would be activating a leg between the two of them. You know, are there other ways that might be easier, be able to work better in a flight plan, other ways to pull this off for a departure that people might use? I know...
I was going to bring up something different.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Just a little bit on this, on knowing whether things have changed. And I got caught by this as an examiner at my own airport, okay? Most of us these days, back in the days of JEPs, I hired a young kid to do my revisions because it was an all-day affair. But in doing those revisions, when you change the RNAV-3 at Columbia County, you see what the change is. But now we all click download and go to bed. And in the morning, we've got our new database. It took an applicant because I said our plan was we were going to fly the RNAV-3 Circle Land 2-1. I had downloaded a new database 2 weeks before, and my applicant said, well, we can't do the circle. And I said, well, why not? And he said, because there are no circling minimums on the approach plate. What I'm getting to is here, okay, there's the water 7. There had been the water 6. We don't know what the changes are. Now, everything might look fine. It's going from LWA to water. What is the change? What is the difference? Could it kill us? And that's why I'm cautious about rolling your own on these things. And with our new technology, quite often, we don't get to see what the differences are.
Well, what would you do in this case? Where do you stand?
Well, the other thing is, if you you get the clearance, and typically we read back the clearance, read back, correct, contact departure, you know, or contact ground for taxi, okay? There'd be cause for hesitation. One of the things that Bruce mentioned was that he realized, ooh, after he's already fired everything up, oh, they hadn't downloaded a new database in years. However, I see so many instrument pilots who turn on that GPS, enter on the 430. They never look at the database date. They never look to see if the CDI, D-bar, and V-bar are correct. It's just enter, and don't even look. This fellow should have had that heads up when he first turned on the GPS.
One more thing about this is, in the scenario, this airplane is new to this pilot. And this is the first time this pilot is going to fly this airplane in IFR. Did a quick checkout in it the day before. And now that he's going out and going to really fly this airplane in the soup, he's first now noticing that the database is out of date. I think if I were in that situation where I was surprised by something like that when I was going out, I'd want to have a moment of pause and think about what else I missed from the day before on this airplane that's new to me that I didn't catch.
I'd say right off the bat, I probably would, if it were IFR and this is a brand new airplane to me, hey, the San Juan Islands are a great place to vacation.
Especially this ratty old pickup truck of an airplane that you just bought.
Right. That you don't have that kind of experience. And I'm glad you brought that up as a point. You know, this is a new airplane to this pilot. And granted, it's only a quick climb through the clouds, right? To get out on top, and then it's VFR the rest of the way. But it's still a climb through the clouds.
Well, one of the kickers in this, in flying this ancient pickup truck that you've never been in before, is if you had to come back, the ILS approach to runway 8, the missed approach fixes water.
Yeah,
one of the miss, or it's, you know, there's an alternate miss, and it's water. So you might have to actually fly this approach, you know, if something went wrong and you can back in. So, you know, just one other piece that you'd have to look at.
It's a hazard of a homemade procedure.
Yeah.
You know, the things you don't see and don't recognize, implications. Well,
yeah, and that's, you know, if we sort of pan back a little bit here, that sort of makes sense, this whole thing. I mean, it's a tiny little section of IFR, right? I mean, this isn't a long IFR flight. This isn't nasty weather. The ceilings are relatively high. Like, if you had to come back into the airport, if you can get on the ILS, you're probably going to break out, right? So it's just like, it's just a little bit of IFR. Yeah, it's a new airplane, but it's just a little bit of IFR you have to handle. And then once you get past that, it'll all be good. Plus the database, plus, you know, the other things that might go wrong. And there's a real trap there, a real temptation for, you know, I just got to get on top or just below and it'll all work out. And that allows us not to think through, or tempts us maybe not to think through, all the implications of how are we actually going to pull that off? And what are we going to do if it doesn't work out the way we thought?